We looked at the story of Adam a couple weeks ago, and last week, Abraham and Isaac, and now we're going to take a look at the story of Joseph, and we're looking to see how the story of Adam, the story of Abraham and Isaac, and the story of Joseph are all telling the gospel story, the same gospel story that will eventually be revealed in Christ. And I would, if you've missed it, I'm not trying to advertise for myself, like to or whatever, but I would really encourage you to podcast it. Because a lot of that stuff is very foundational. If you're confused today, it might help you understand a little bit more where we're coming from. So go ahead and download that. We're real high tech. We got podcasting and all that jazz, or you can just listen to it on our website. But the story of Joseph is huge. It's about 20 chapters. So if you guys want to stand, we're just going to read all of it. I'm just kidding. You don't have to. It would take all of our time. So I'm going to try my best to summarize it. And since it's so big, I'm only going to focus on a few parts, obviously. I mean, we could make a year-long series out of this story, and there is so much to pack. It is overwhelming to study. There's just so many things I just wanted to spend time in, but we had to keep moving through. And since it's so big, I just want to summarize it. Before we unpack, I'm going to go ahead and retell the story. I'm going to read a few verses and just kind of read and summarize a lot. So the story begins in Genesis chapter 37. And I want you to, before we get started, I want you to remember that this is a real story. This isn't like fable. This isn't like some kind of just made-up story that years down the road the author was like, you know, I think it'd be really good to write this story and we can get some nice things. This is stuff that happened. And what's cool is that this ties in with Adam. It ties in with Abraham and Jacob. Or I'm sorry, Abraham and his son Isaac. So this all goes together. So, Genesis 37. If you guys have a Bible, you want to follow along the story. It's going to be kind of hard to follow because I'm going to be flying through some parts, reading some parts. Try your best. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah, whatever. And you just gotta read them fast and confident. Nobody will know, right? And Zilpha, his father's wife. Great names. And Joseph brought a bad report. This is a false report. So this is Joseph being a tattletale. He's tattling on his brothers to them, to their father. So now... Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. We get this, the Broadway show, Joseph and the Technicolor or something like that. I don't know what it's called. But, you know, he had a robe of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Joseph was his father's favorite. And because of this, his brothers hated him. Now, just parenting 101, don't pick a favorite. This won't happen. Don't pick a favorite. That's poor parenting. Come on. Jacob, you knew better than that. So then Joseph has this dream and sets the scene for the rest of Joseph's life. I mean, this dream, you want to pay attention to it. It sets the tone, verse 5, for the rest of his life. Now, Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear this dream I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright, and behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf." His brother said to him, "Are you indeed to reign over us? Or are you indeed to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. So one day when Jacob sends Joseph out to check on his brothers again, they had really decided that they've had enough with him. They've had enough with Joseph. They're just going to kill him. So when Reuben steps in, he's like, "No, guys, we cannot kill him. This is murder." So what they end up doing is they literally rip his coat off. This is the same word as like that they used to describe skinning an animal. They literally skin the robe off of him. They cast him into a pit without water mockingly ignoring his cries, and he's screaming, and he sells them to the Midianite traders in their way on their way to Egypt. They tear his tunic, they dump a bunch of goat's blood on it, take it to their dad, and just say, look what happened. And there, Jacob really drew his own conclusions, saying that a wild beast must have killed him. And of course, they all thought he was dead, except the brothers. His father thought he was dead. Meanwhile, Joseph had been sold to Potiphar. He's a very wealthy military leader. Though he started as a regular, Joseph started as a regular house slave, God blessed Joseph's hard work so that Potiphar makes him the head steward of the entire estate. And this is a pretty big deal. And things are great for 10 years. He's building this great relationship with Potiphar. He serves him well. He runs things very well. Until, about 10 years later, the missus, Potiphar's wife, steps in and gets the hots for Joseph and comes to him with this intense boldness. And she literally says, and the Hebrew is really cool to study there if you like to do that kind of thing. Really cool. She's basically saying, sex now. Like, sex now. Like, this is, I'm not asking you, I'm not coming on to you, I'm not trying to turn you on. We're having sex right now. And so, of course, this freaks Joseph out, and a couple days go by, and she's being very persistent about this. She's being very, very forceful, and Joseph declines. But one day, she catches his robe, rips it off again, and Joseph takes off, and she claims that Joseph raped her. She's very powerful, so of course, this becomes big news. Potiphar finds out, of course, and because Joseph had gained so much favor, Potiphar decided not to go ahead and kill him, which he had every right to do, but instead just throws him in jail. And this isn't like cable TV, bed, and conjugal visits. This is like a hole-in-the-wall dungeon where you rot and die. That's what this jail is. So it's basically a sentence of death in many ways. We see that Joseph, he's in jail all the way back at the bottom again. After he had became a slave, rose up to be the head servant, now he's back in jail. Or not back, but he's in jail all the way at the bottom. And while he's in jail, he made huge impression on the prison guards, basically. And so the prison guards, he had earned so much favor with them that they went ahead and made him like the chief prison guard. So he rises back up to be in charge of the other prisoners. And then Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and like his baker get thrown into jail. They get thrown into jail with him. We don't understand why. But it's interesting, isn't it? Coincidence? One night they both have this dream. They have a really, really weird dream that really disturbed them. And God enables Joseph to explain the meaning of their dream, which we see 3 days later, this dream really came true. What Joseph said was right. And he asks the cupbearer to put in a good word for him because the cupbearer's cupbearer is going back to Pharaoh. He gets released. He's going back to Pharaoh. But once again, the cupbearer really forgets about his promise. He forgets about it. And we see that basically this he was forgot about for 2 more years. So he's in jail for a couple more years, even after this, him interpreting the dream. Then an amazing thing happens. Pharaoh has this weird dream. 14 cows, which no one can explain. A dream about 14 cows. Nobody can explain this. A lot of people came in, tried, but nobody could. Then the cupbearer's memory is jogged. And he remembers Joseph recommends him after Pharaoh, and the others tried to interpret. And it's interesting. You know, I can imagine the cupbearer be like, hey, you know, I know a guy I met in prison. You gotta check him out. I mean, he's legit. Like, he can help you out. I know this guy. He's cool. You know, like, Pharaoh's like, sure, all right. I'm just looking at these details and thinking something had to be manipulated here. Nobody does that, you know? So standing in front of Pharaoh, God enables him to explain the dream as a prediction. Now listen to this. It's a prediction of 7 years of great crops. They're going to have 7 years of amazing crops. Everything's going to be very healthy. All the crops are going to be very healthy. They're going to have an abundance. And by year seven, a famine will hit. A famine will hit. And so Pharaoh takes this to heart. And he says, all right, well, then we need to find somebody who can be in charge of storing up, who's kind of some kind of starting and executing some grain storage system or something like that. And Pharaoh says, I think you're the best guy for the job, Joseph. You've obviously proven yourself worthy, and I'm sure Potiphar put in a good word. Now, maybe he found out, Potiphar's wife confessed, I don't know. So in one day, Joseph goes, and listen to this, Joseph goes from the pit back into the palace. Joseph spends the next 7 years getting married, starting a family, and really executing the storage plan. He does a great job doing it, too. He does a really good job. He's like a great business guy. Then the famine hits. The famine is severe. It's severe all across Canaan, where Joseph came out of and his family still lives. I mean, they live kind of far away, and the famine was even was worse for them as well. And so Jacob calls his sons to go. Jacob, you remember Jacob, Joseph's dad? He calls his sons to go into Egypt, buy food before they run out. They're almost ready to run out. They can't run out of food, so he tells them, go get food. They get to Egypt, sent to the guy in charge of the food. It was Joseph. And then chapter 37, verse 7 says that they bowed down to him. They bowed down to him. And Joseph immediately recognizes them, but they don't recognize Joseph. I mean, when they sold Joseph, he was 17. Of course, he was wearing his fancy robe. And now he's 40. He's 40 years old. He's wearing all the Egyptian garb. He is the one in charge of everything. There's no way they would think that this guy could be Joseph. There's no possible way. But Joseph definitely recognizes them. So Joseph kind of takes action against them. He accuses them of being spies. Very strange, but he accuses them of being spies and says that he won't believe them. He won't believe that they're from this land unless, and they have all these this more family, unless they bring their youngest brother to him. So Joseph locks up Simon. He locks him up. It's kind of as collateral. Locks him up, and sends the other brothers back home to get the youngest son, Benjamin. And Benjamin was very, very precious to the family because it was kind of the next chosen one, the next special child that his father believed was very special because he came to him in his old age. And so we see a mixed emotion. We see tons of mixed emotions from Joseph because I see at this time he's weeping. So I think there's like this anger, frustration with him or with his brothers that he just can't let it go. But at the same time, he desires forgiveness so much. There's this tension in him. They need to be taught a lesson, right? But yet, he wants to forgive them. You can feel it in the text. It's an amazing emotion. And when they get home, Jacob melts at the thought of letting Benjamin, his son, go. Because I'm sure he's like, I've got a son in jail. He's in jail there. I've got one who's already died. And you just want me to entrust my youngest son to you. You just want me to do this. I don't know if I can. And he refuses to let Benjamin go. But they get hungrier and hungrier, and they won't make it much longer. The rest of the family is going to die of starvation, and they need food badly. So Jacob tells them to return to Egypt for more grain. And Jacob agrees and lets Benjamin go. And they go back to Joseph. Joseph releases Simon, and it's funny that He even dines with them. He sits down and dines with them. This was very, this is not common. This is very, this is bad that they were doing this, that the Egyptian ruler here was sitting down and dining with these Israelites. And so, so moved, Joseph was so moved by seeing Benjamin that he has to remove himself from the room to weep. We see that. He has to leave because he's so torn up with emotion. The next day, Joseph loads him up with grain. And here we go back to kind of this, like, they need to, like, understand the weight of what they've done. So he has one of his servants take his favorite, the most precious cup. And this is a really important cup. We totally don't get that, but this is like a very nice TV or something, I don't know. And he puts it in Benjamin's sack of grain. They all have sacks of grain. He puts it in Benjamin's. So he plants that in there and says, and they leave. And so Joseph sends some people out after him, because of course he knows about this, and basically says to them, so this is how you repay the master's kindness, right? You steal my favorite cup. So they're offended. They're frustrated. We didn't steal your cup. What are you talking about? And they say, you can kill whoever stole your cup because we know nobody stole the cup. So, of course, he goes through, checks all the bags, finds the cup, and it's in Benjamin's bag. And his brothers are beside themselves. They're so frustrated. So they're all sort of cuffed. Put in the wagon, the paddy wagon, I guess, of those days, literally paddy wagon, and they're brought before Joseph. And Judah says, what can we say? We are being punished by God for our past sins. Isn't that an amazing statement? We're being punished by God for our past sins. And he begs Joseph to make him a slave rather than Benjamin. Substitute me instead of my brother. Take me instead of Benjamin, because my father can't bear it anymore for him to be dead. My father has already lost one son. He cannot lose this son. Take me instead. Very different attitude now from Joseph. Chapter 51, verse 1. I want to read some. Then Joseph, I love this part. This is where it really slows down for me, and you just, The kind of the climax of the story in chapter 41 or 45. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." No one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers, and he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it. People outside the walls heard it, and that the household of Pharaoh heard it. I mean, he is weeping loud. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer, for they were in dismay at his presence. There's no way this could be Joseph. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now you do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. Listen to this. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over the land of Egypt." Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck. And he kissed his brothers and wept on them. After that, his brothers talked with him. What an amazing story. Isn't this an amazing story? I want to point out a few things really quick that I think will help us understand and see the story as it should be seen. Now, I think if we miss these points, we might miss sort of the thesis or the overarching theme of this passage. Oftentimes we read these stories. We read stories like this, or Abraham and Isaac, or Adam. I know I've said this before the last few weeks, but we look at these and we say, if we live like Joseph, God will bless us. Be like Joseph. If we have faith like him, if we trust God like him, if we worship like him, if we have that kind of faith, then God will surely bless us. He'll give us salvation. And what's amazing is as we look at these characters, I mean, there's so much to be gleaned from them and their character and their personalities, but really they aren't heroes. They aren't heroes at all. They're obviously just fools, very prideful, tons of brokenness, just a depth of sin. And we overlook a lot of that because it really turns out for good, doesn't it? It turns out for good, and we miss so much of their depth and so much of their pride. And in the Bible, these stories, they're not just telling us how to live good lives. I mean, if that was all this story was telling, I think we would be confused at best, and we would be driven to despair at worst. Was this story meant to give us some tips on, you know, how to be a good dad? You know, look at Jacob. Don't be like him. Be a better dad than Jacob. Don't favor your kids. You know, you could go there. How about maybe a good inspirational poster, like, hang in there when times get tough. One day you'll be ruler of Egypt, you know, something like that. Hang in there. I could see it now. The purpose of these stories is to see how God's grace breaks into your life against your will. I'm sure that made some of you uncomfortable, but let me say that again. The Bible stories are there. These stories are there to show you that God's grace breaks into your life, even if it's against your will, to save you from sin and brokenness that you would never be able to overcome otherwise. That is what we see on every page. That is what I'm seeing on every single story, and especially these stories. What I'm getting at is something that we generally hate to hear. It's very frustrating. The point is that we're out of control. We are out of control. Sin and grace infiltrate us outside of ourselves. Therefore, we don't have control. And the thing is that we get into these problems because of how we grew up. You see, Jacob didn't have control over these situations that he was in. He didn't have control of these situations. This came outside of himself. And his salvation, his grace, his change is not going to come from within. Him saying, you know what, I'm not going to get killed today. I'm not going to be made a slave today. He doesn't do that. He needs help from outside of himself. And we do too. We need family. We need mom, dad. We need that, but even more importantly, we need each other, family, to really bring about healing in our lives. We need to be in community. We need to be in community groups with one another. But even stronger than that, even stronger than community, is that we need our God's grace. We need God's grace to break through our very stubborn lives. That is the difference between religion and Christianity. Religion versus gospel. Religion is if you obey, If you obey, then God will accept you. But Christianity, what the gospel says is if you are accepted, then you will obey. And there's a huge difference between those two. Huge difference between obedience and acceptance. And understanding these two things will help us understand the story. All right, I know that was a ridiculously long introduction, but I want to point out two things. Could go into many, but two things. The temptation of Joseph. I want to look at his temptations and really the quietness of God. There are two major temptations that Joseph faces. Two major temptations. The temptation of power and sexual temptation. You know these got to be good. Power and sex. Two things we love to talk about. Power temptation. Joseph has been sold and he's working for Potiphar. Potiphar was one of the most powerful men in all of the land at the time. I mean, he was very powerful, and we can't understand quite how powerful. He was very powerful. He's basically just under Pharaoh in terms of power. And there are two major examples of how power is used in this passage. First, we look at the power that Potiphar's wife has. Potiphar's wife. And then also I want to look at the power that Joseph had. So there's Joseph. He had obtained a great deal of power. I know that you see that he became Potiphar's attendant. That's what that's translated. But this wasn't just Joseph having a little butler suit on, running around getting tea and coffee and making beds and cleaning toilets. He wasn't doing this. He's like the COO. Some of you are like, COO, what is that? The chief operating officer. He was like the man running the business. He was very important running the business. Potiphar's wife used her power to get what she wanted, and look how Joseph used his power. Look in chapter 39, verse 5. If you want to flip there, he used his power for the sake of what the Lord wanted. And what I find completely mind-boggling, something we can easily pass over, is that Potiphar's house was blessed. It says that Potiphar's house was blessed. Potiphar wasn't even, he didn't know anything about the Lord. He was not a follower of the Lord, yet his house was blessed because of Joseph's influence, and even his presence in the house is blessed. What do we learn from this? Something I thought was worthy of spending some time on, because I know a lot of y'all are jobless. I mean, y'all, half of you would be like, I don't have a job, or you know, you don't know what you're going to do with the rest of your life. Most of you are trying to figure out what's next. What's the next chapter in life? And this is a big conversation that John Badgley's in my community group, plays guitar here, him and I have had, and it's something that even Matt and Ashley, you guys are here, right? Even they, just thinking about their story, they're living proof of this, but for some reason, we have got it in our heads that as a Christian culture, that the most spiritual thing that you can do is be a missionary or be a preacher or be pastor or be on staff with Campus Crusade or Young Life. Like, that's the spiritual thing to do. I mean, I'm a very spiritual person. I disciple people well. Therefore, I must be on staff with Campus Crusade or whatever. And we think that the only people God uses are the missionaries and pastors. You know, you see the book at the book table, it says, men that God used. You flip through it, missionary, pastor, preacher, missionary, Bible study leader, something like that. And but what we see here is Joseph is not a preacher, he's not a Bible study leader, yet God used him in huge ways. And something that I learned from Tim Keller, who's an influential pastor, by the way, is that we have to... We have to stop seeing leading a Bible study are doing traditional missions, going overseas and being professional missionaries, or preaching like me as the best way to influence the world, but that God uses very sharp, innovative business leaders to effect more change in culture. I've been really taken back by this as I've thought about a lot of you all who have no idea what you want to do with the rest of your life. You have a lot of people saying, hey, you got to go on staff, man. You are a godly person. You got to do it. Or, man, you're a preacher. You are really good at communicating. You should definitely take up a job, raise some support. Let's get you on as a preacher. You know, something like that. You're hearing a lot of that. So, but what we don't need, what the church does not need, is more Young Life or Campus Crusade staff or more Bible study leaders, more preachers, but we need more godly leaders in business, in law, in medicine, in politics, in art, and so on. We need more godly people in that. I'm going to use Matt Martin. Where are you, Matt? I'm going to use you as an example real quick. I hope you don't mind. Matt and I have been friends for a very long time. He's one of the leaders at our church here. He was contemplating going to the mission field, him and Ashley, thinking about missions, maybe seminary is the next step, going overseas somewhere to influence people for the gospel, and we definitely need that. We need that. We need you. If you're feeling called to do that, yes, go. But they decided to uproot their lives in Dayton and root themselves in the business, Matt, in urban development. In urban development, being involved at the Kerwin Institute up on campus, and Ashley involved in medicine. And what I think is amazing is that they have an opportunity to really influence the city in a much different way than I ever will as a preacher, as a pastor. He's in a position where Time Magazine's calling him, and he's getting to be able to really see statistics that presidential campaigns want and be able to conduct studies like that. We need more people like that. We need more of you to do stuff like that. Regular jobs. We need people who will be in places of power to use your skills, to be such a hard worker that you are the CFO of your business. That you're in places like Nationwide, that you're in places like Chase Bank, at Battelle, places, those big businesses in this city where you will be able to be an influence in that business and affect greater change in this city than I could ever do. We need more people to be professors. We need more people to be business owners, to be in places like that. In politics, whatever, to affect change to the glory of God. And we see this temptation that Joseph had with this power to take that temptation and say, I am going to use this for my own power, for my own glory. And that temptation had to be there for him. But we see that he was not taken by this power, but used it for the glory of his name, glory of God's name. And what did God do? He blessed the house of Pharaoh. Imagine if you guys are in these businesses. Imagine God saying, I bless Chase Bank because you're there. Because you are there as a head, as an influence, as a representative. And we need more people like that. So that's Joseph's first temptation, is to use power for himself. The second temptation I want to look at is Joseph's sexual temptation. In chapter 39, we see that Joseph was a very good-looking guy. He was super good-looking. He had to be ripped. I mean, he's out in the fields helping these guys. Very beautiful, nice tan. He had to be very beautiful. Potiphar's wife definitely thought he was a good-looking guy. So in her power, I want to focus on her. She demanded that Joseph have sex with her. And like I said, the literal interpretation, this blew me away, is that she's not just saying, come here, baby, let's get it on. You know, some things that some of you dudes dream of. She's like, sex here now. Some things most of you probably still dream of. But now, Now, I know in a lot of this, it sounds amazing to some of you guys, but what is going on here wasn't just a betrayal of Potiphar. And he didn't just see this as like, no, I can't. You know, you're married. Potiphar's real good to me, that kind of thing. It says in verse 9, chapter 39, verse 9, how then can I do a great wickedness and sin against God? Joseph does not want to betray God. He doesn't want to betray God because you know what? He's looking outside of himself. He's looking outside of himself for a way out, for fleeting, from running. Let that be application enough for you people who are struggling with sexual temptation. When you think that it's an amazing thing when a woman comes to you and says, sex now. Let it be a way for you to flee and say, you know what? I'm single, you're single, that sounds all right. You know, we can do a little bit of sin together and God's grace will cover that. You know, no. Because you are not sinning just against her, against your future spouse, against him. You're sinning against God. Not. I love how he doesn't look inside himself, say, you know, I need the latest self-help book to get me out of this situation. I just need to be a good moral person, but I need to look to God. So we see this power temptation that he has sent, that he's gone through, and the sexual temptation that had to be very hard. He wasn't married. I want to move on to my second major point, the quietness of God. When reading this story, do you stop? Do you stop and notice every detail? Just stop and just go back and read through this and notice every little detail, because it's riddled with tons of details. And when you notice every detail, do you see if every detail wasn't there, the big picture isn't there? And what I'm saying that is if he had been killed and his brother hadn't stepped in and been like, no, let's not kill him. Let's just sell him. We can make a little bit of money off this. Not kill him. But if he would have just been killed and not sold, if every little detail not have happened, they all would have died. Everyone would have been dead. The whole land of Egypt would have been gone. They all would have died of starvation. His brothers, his dad, all of Egypt. But the famine is coming. And Joseph has to get into the place where he has power. He has to be in a place where Pharaoh can put him in charge. And has to be in a place where he can stop the people from starving to death. Now, if you're reading this story, you notice that all the stories we've read, God has been right there. He's been communicating. He called down from heaven to Abraham, telling him not to kill his son. But if you read this story, God is silent. Where's God? Why isn't he telling Joseph, okay, buddy, here's what's next? You know, where is he? And especially in chapter 37, God is mentioned everywhere but here. Why? And this is something we can miss again. We'll stop and ask why. Because the author, this is very beautiful, the way the author writes this. I find this fascinating. That the author is communicating that though you don't see him, though you don't feel him, he's there. In the details, he's arranging the details because it is through those details that will ultimately bring him through his journey. We see in 37, 23, somewhere in there, so much in there. Well, as I said in this story, he's telling when his brothers come to him and they strip, they literally skin his robe off of him like they skin an animal. I mean, this is very violent. They ripped it off of him. They left him naked. I'm sure they had to beat him up because this you know, 17-year-old getting jumped by his brothers, I'm sure he didn't go down quietly. We see that he didn't go down quietly, but they threw him, they casted him into a pit. That word cast, the word cast is used to describe like throwing a dead corpse, leaving him dead. And the translations just miss a lot of that. But later we learn that Joseph, down in this hole, cried and screamed, and I'm sure he yelled until his lungs were raw, "Brothers, why have you abandoned me? Why, come back to me. Help me." All of those things, just screaming out to his brothers. And do you see how violent this is? How awful this is? How could his brothers be so heartless? I don't get along with my brother that well, but I could never do something like this to him. So they were just so angry that they left their brother for dead. Do you see that if these little details hadn't happened, Joseph would never have become a slave. He never would have been broken. Listen to this. He never would have been broken of his pride. You remember Joseph, the arrogant punk? We see, he's got to be this arrogant jerk. His father was spoiling him, giving him this pretty beautiful coat. None of his other brothers got that. He loved him way more than his other brothers. The opening line is that he went and tattled on his brothers, a big tattletale. He was a spoiled brat. And if this never had happened, he never would have been broken of his pride, and he would have never been able to not only save Egypt, but his own family's lives in the end. All of these awful little details, if they all hadn't happened, there would be no salvation. And let me stop here for a second. I know many of you at this point would say, this is what I said, God didn't have to do it so violently, right? I mean, it didn't have to be so messy. I mean, he could have simplified everything. He could have cleaned this all up. He could have sent Tess and Monica. You guys know who I'm talking about? Touch by an angel. He could have sent them. They could have, they're glowing. They were glowing. It's very beautiful. He could have said, "Jacob, now you are spoiling Joseph and making him an idol. He's becoming just a selfish, good-for-nothing, spoiled brat. So you just need to be a better father and start paying attention to the rest of your sons, because you're going to have an uprising. Something's going to go bad. Joseph, you have some problems of your own. You're a spoiled little brat. You really need to man up. And brothers, you're about to kill Joseph. That's murder. Stop. All right? All done." They're like, "Okay, let's just cry about this for a moment, and we'll let music come in, and it'll be a beautiful movie, a beautiful TV episode that we call Touched by an Angel. It'd just been perfect." I mean, wouldn't that have been better? Wouldn't that have been better? I know many of you, as I know myself in this, that even if the angel came to me, came to you, and tried to set all things right, came to set all things right for this, we wouldn't have listened. No one can ever learn about their faults by being told. We have to be shown, don't we? Listen, the same is with God's love. We can't be told about God's love. It doesn't work by him just telling us. He has to show us. We have to be shown. We have to be shown God's love. Joseph's sin was very complex. The issues that he had were very complex. Hebrews 12 talks about him a little bit. It alludes to him. We'll get to that later. But if God had just shown up and stopped him, he would have been worse off than before. Not only would have he been worse off before, but all of Egypt would have been worse off. All of Canaan would have been worse off. They would have been dead. Joseph needed this journey. And for some, the journey is not hard. Some people get the easy life. Some people get the very easy life. And I recently heard a sermon a while back by Matt Chandler. He said just made a great point. Some will be eaten by lions. We see this from Hebrews 11. Some will be eaten by lions. They will be cut by the sword, and then some will be raised to glory. Some people, but all, both of those for the glory of God. I mean, you see this all throughout the scripture. Peter goes to jail. Remember the story? Peter goes to jail. All the people back at the house are praying for him. Angel goes to jail, gets him out, puts him to sleep, puts the prison guards to sleep. He walks right out. John the Baptist, he goes to jail, and what happens? He gets his head cut off. And we see at this same place, at this place where all this is happening, where Joseph went to find his brothers, this pit that he was in, the same place, hundreds of years later, we see Elijah surrounded by enemy armies. He's about to get killed, and what happens? He prays, and angels come, and they cut everybody down, and he's saved. Just like that. The same place that Joseph is being killed, or being beaten, being thrown into the pit, being left for dead, being sold into slavery, the same place that Elijah was in, just like that, he was taken care of. It's amazing to me, even personally, how I've seen friends who've planted churches, who've started churches, just like ours. They have great vision. They're very gospel-centered. They preach the Bible. They love Jesus. They're just doing things very well. But they haven't seen anybody become a Christian. They've got, 30, 50 people coming to their church every week. They're struggling. And I sit down with them. I'm talking. And I'm like, yeah, well, 1 year we've got 200 people. We've had dozen people become Christians. We've baptized dozens of people. And you know what? When I started understanding that God has chosen both, some to be thrown in the pit and to go through a journey of hardship and some to have it easy, you start seeing things differently. Because when you're on that journey and you're seeing that life is horrible, life is hard, you're seeing that God is using this just as much as the next guy. So you're not pointing at him and saying, God, this isn't fair. Why can't it be like this guy? I mean, he's got the big church. He's got the great job. He's getting paid well. He's got the hot wife. All of those things. Why am I stuck in where I'm at? When we get this, when we get that God has chosen a different journey for us all, and it'll all result in his glory, when we get that, it changes our perspective on everything. And I know some of you feel like God doesn't answer your prayers. You always feel dry, depressed, frustrated. You're wondering, how is the other guy got it all so easy? And I know some of you feel like that. You're up and down and up and down. You're on fire for God 1 week. The next week, you're in the pit whining and crying about how you just don't feel God. You didn't experience God in your quiet time today. When you start seeing that God's journey for us is right journey, God's journey for us is the right journey, doesn't that give you strength? To know that God is working just as much in Joseph as Elijah, just as much as Peter as in John the Baptist. The third, last point. It was very hard in the middle of this whole story for Joseph and his brothers to see what was happening. He could not see what was happening, blind to it. He just felt this pain, this anguish, and they didn't see the means of grace that God was creating for salvation for them. You see, in all these stories, in Abraham and Isaac and Adam, and now in Joseph, they really didn't understand what was happening. Joseph's brothers, at the very end of this story, we see them completely blown away. They were completely blown away by what God took Joseph through in order to bring salvation to not only them, but to the people of Egypt. I mean, can you imagine that? You sell your brother to slavery, and then you, years down the road, you find out that the same brother brought your salvation and brought the people of Egypt's salvation. Centuries later, a man came who was tempted, who was betrayed, who felt abandoned. There was another Joseph. He had the power, He had the glory, the status, and like Joseph, he lost it. We're told in Isaiah 53 that he had no appearance of beauty, majesty. We see that he was despised by his own people. And there, so much of Joseph's life is foreshadowing Jesus. The one who came centuries later. Joseph was thrown in with the transgressors and thrown in jail with the transgressors, the cupbearer, with the other prisoners, all these people. And he did nothing wrong. He didn't do anything wrong. But he was thrown in with these people. Jesus was thrown in as well, leaving his glory to be thrown in with us transgressors, us sinful people. And he endured to the end. Though Satan tempted him in the desert, though he faced all the temptations we faced, he endured. Why? Because he doesn't want to offend anybody? Because he doesn't want to cheat on anybody's wife? Because of, why? He did it for us. He did it for us. And when we see this, when we understand that we are his passion, when we understand that Jesus came into our sinful, messed up, jacked up world, when he came in it, when we start seeing that, then he becomes our passion. He becomes our passion and the one we want to live for. And we need to see that through Jesus, we can face temptation. That's why Paul wrote, flee sexual immorality. For you were bought with a price. You're not of your own. You were bought with a price. Do you see that? When we see that we are bought with a price, then when we see that he came and entered into our transgressions, then we can flee sexual immorality. Same thing Joseph was trying to tell us. The same thing. You think that in the middle, you know what God is doing. When you think he is not there, when you're frustrated and you think he's not there, remember that Jesus understood this abandonment. He was betrayed by his brothers. He was mocked when he told people that he was the Son of God. And when worship was due to him, he was just ridiculed and mocked. And he was stripped. Jesus was stripped of his robe. He was left to die. But God was with Jesus. And as Hebrew 11 and 12 tells us that some will be killed and some will be praised, but no matter what, we are called to, as chapter 12 says, lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. And he is now seated at the right hand of the Father. He's sitting at the right hand, the throne of God. If you keep reading in Hebrews 12, you'll see that the writer is taking us to those of you who feel that God is not there. You feel that God has abandoned you. He is punishing you. But Hebrews doesn't say, be like Joseph, pick yourselves up, be a good leader. But he says, you have a king. You have someone who is far more powerful than you are, who is seated at the right hand, who sympathizes with your suffering. Do you see that Joseph just isn't a fairy tale? It's not just a fairy tale that just so happens, coincidentally, to have similarities to Jesus. This story that actually happened as a historical truth happened to remind people that Jesus, though brought low, is now seated at the right hand of the Father. This is Jesus. This is Jesus. Jesus was loved by his Father. He was betrayed by his brothers for silver. He was falsely accused. He was beaten up. He was stripped of his robe. He was mourned as dead, but is not dead. All the earth comes to him to be fed. He offers grace and forgiveness, especially to those who have betrayed him. He is our substitute. That's what the older brother was trying to come across when he's saying, "Don't sacrifice Benjamin, sacrifice me." Do you see, we are the brothers. We're the brothers in this story who've sold Jesus, betrayed him, and come to him, bowing down, needing his grace. We need to be fed by him. We need to be in his care. We need to be following his leadership. This is our Lord. This is our Lord Jesus, the one who is foretold by the story of Joseph. Let's pray. Father, we come and know that this story is heavy. There is so much we missed that we couldn't unpack, that we couldn't talk about today. But God, I pray that the impact would be the same, that we would be blown away, just blown away by your grace, by your provision, by the fact that this story isn't telling us just to be better people, just to wise up, be smarter, be morally secure, whatever. But God, this story tells us of the one who is to come, who we now know, Jesus. So we praise you, Jesus, that you come to take away the sins of the world, that though you have been brought low, just like Joseph, you've gone from the pit to the palace. You've gone from low to the king of all of creation. You left your status to be like us, and you have raised back to your status. Therefore, Jesus, we worship you as our king. In Jesus' name, amen.